Voices Confederation by Don Elkins and Carla L. Rucatel. The house was situated in middle-class, suburban normalcy in one of the small cities around Louisville, Kentucky. But inside the dark room, the 15 people were acting somewhat oddly. If you looked closely, the faint light that filtered through the fabric of the closed curtain was sufficient to reveal that a few of the people there were opening and closing their mouths, and occasionally one of them would rapidly move his tongue, making a clicking sound with his mouth. Then one of those present began to speak in a strange, extremely forced manner. "Greetings in the love and the light of the infinite creator," he blurted. Another person asked, "Are you nearby?" In the same strained voice, the first speaker suggested that if the person who asked would come outside, they would show him the craft. First all 15 people went outside for the craft, but they saw nothing but a clear and starry sky. The people went back inside and resumed their former posture. Again the speaker with the strained voice suggested that if the one who had asked where the craft was would come outside, this person would be shown their craft. The questioner immediately left the group. When he got outside he waited for no more than 20 seconds. Then he saw an orangish light, which crossed the sky until it came to rest over his head. It then changed colors, from orange through blue to white. It remained fixed for a few seconds, larger than Venus, but smaller than the moon. Then it disappeared. 5. Introduction. I was one of the 15 who were at that meeting in February, 1963. I did not see that UFO. However, careful questioning of the man who saw it convinced me that the phenomenon was within the limits for definite classification as an unidentified object. I have, however, seen two other UFOs, and have pursued numerous allegations of contact with UFOs since that time. This volume is intended to put before you some of the data I have gathered. I met Hal Price in 1962. He was a design engineer and had recently been transferred from Detroit to Louisville. Mr. Price told me that he'd been in a group of people in Detroit who had received regular telepathic communications from flying saucer pilots. I was somewhat skeptical about his claim until I read some of the messages that had been received in Detroit. The general content of the material was identical to that which I personally had been receiving since 1952. My own telepathic contact had induced me to investigate paranormal phenomena in general deeply, and to conduct several hundred experiments studying extrasensory ability, in particular under hypnosis. The important factor that I had overlooked in my research was being demonstrated by the Detroit group. It was possible to convert telepathic impressions directly into language and then speak, just as if the telepath were acting as a radio receiver. I immediately planned an experiment using Mr. Price as an instructor of technique. I had no trouble at all finding volunteers for the experiment. At the time I was teaching at the Speed Scientific School, a college of the University of Louisville, and I had more than enough interested students available for a study group. We had close to 100 people in the experiment before a year was up, and over a dozen had been extremely faithful members. These students 6, introduction, made up the preponderance of the group. However, a couple of dozen volunteers from other areas were also involved. How to conduct such an unorthodox experiment could have been a difficult question. However, we had previous instructions given to us by the Detroit group. This data was, of course, only alleged to be from the aliens in the flying saucers. But since we were attempting to talk to them, we decided to take their alleged advice as to how to do so. The information given us by the Detroit group was simple. Our instructions were to sit, as a group, quietly, in the dark, in an upright position, with the spine as vertical as possible and then to think of nothing. These were very simple instructions, sit up straight and think of nothing. Many found them difficult to follow, at first. It took some practice to find the knack of it. One or two nights each week for the next 2 months, we sat in the dark together with our eyes closed, thinking of nothing, or as near to nothing as possible. We awaited results, but no results had yet transpired. We felt a bit subdued about the experiment until a member of the Detroit group came to us for a visit. He joined us in our meeting and spoke to us, telepathically channeling the alleged thoughts of a UFO naut, who assured us that if we continued our meetings, we would have success in receiving their thoughts. We felt cheered by this encouragement, and continued our meetings as before. Within a few weeks, results began to manifest themselves. An unusual phenomenon which we came to call conditioning began occurring to almost every member of the group. As we sat in the darkened room, eyes closed, letting our minds run down, we found, one by one, that our mouth and tongue muscles were being exercised. The exercise would often be abrupt, almost painful, with the mouth flying open vehemently, or the tongue flopping and gyrating so quickly that it made popping and flapping sounds. 7. Introduction. If this had happened to only one person, it would simply have been very funny, and indeed it was sometimes difficult not to laugh, as we all sat around making these strange sounds, but this happened to all but one of the most faithful members of the group. It was several weeks before the conditioning period began to give way to the breakthrough of speaking. Participants in the group slowly began to find their mouths forming words, instead of unintelligible sounds and silent movements. They began to speak one word at a time, involuntarily. This progress was always quite slow initially, but in time, practice seemed to make perfect, and the channel would become more and more fluent, less and less controlled and jerky in his delivery. In the messages herein printed, you will find the alleged UFO naut's own explanation of the various types of channeling. The data we received and the results we were and are getting bring us up against the problem of data evaluation. I had originally intended to design a system of experimentation with controlled boundaries so that material of a scientifically evidential nature could be produced, but before the first month of the experiment had ended, I had begun to realize that this phenomenon would not lend itself to rigorous analytical control. The basic phenomenon of telepathic contact could not even be adequately researched. Had we been able to show concrete evidence of telepathy, it would still have been very difficult to prove evidentially from where the contact emanated. Of one thing we were certain, we would have an abundance of data. All but one of the original group had manifested the same syndrome of conditioning and, subsequently, speaking, and their messages from the alleged UFO naut had begun to collect. This material was amazingly self-consistent, and coincided in content and in style with messages received from 8. Introduction. The same all-edged source it places all over the continent. Indeed, this pile of messages has continued to grow until now. I can offer you, in this book, only a small part of the material we have in our files. It seemed rather an exaggeration of scientific caution to declare that all of the people who exhibited the conditioning and speaking syndrome were suffering from identical forms of mental aberration. Since the original group was studied, many others have developed, and the process is always the same, sometimes much accelerated as compared with our early experience, but it is always the same general syndrome and process. We have gone ahead in securing in-depth data, which we present to you for your own evaluation. I have spent many an hour reflecting on what this experiment has produced, and what scientific or non-scientific questions could be said to find an answer from within this material. And I have concluded that because of the nature of the material received, there are no systems of evaluation extant which can be used to judge this body of data. The system of evaluation that may emerge for this in the future will, I believe, have its principal keys within this data itself. I base this rather presumptuous and logically dubitable assertion on a thought I have found stated well by Thomas Gouge, a Canadian philosopher of science. Gouge is considering the problems of evaluation of new scientific advances, and he writes, "Roughly I'd say that a necessary condition of scientific advance is that allowance must be made for a, genuinely new empirical observations and b, new explanation schemes." 1. Sagan, Cal, and Thornton Page. UFOs, a Scientific Debate. Ithaca, Cornell UP, c. 1972. p.38. 1. 9. Introduction. Gouge goes on to point out that he feels that the scientific establishment's view of UFO phenomena is that UFOs are either not scientific data or else are misinterpretations of natural objects, and that he finds this type of judgmental approach to reject a necessary condition of scientific advance. 2. Having reasoned that I could not possibly arrange a scientifically evidential experiment, and aware that I lacked the ability to formulate the new explanation scheme, which Gauge postulates as necessary for evaluating new information, I had the choice of either being overcome with a sense of futility, or carrying on with the data gathering as best as possible. A great deal of this data have now been accumulated, and I feel at this point that I can take a position on UFOs. The position is perhaps best stated as being one of direct disagreement with the Condon Committee's statement of summary after the completion of their one-year, $500,000 research program for the investigation of UFOs. Dr. Condon wrote, "Our general conclusion is that nothing has come from the study of UFOs in the past 21 years that has added to scientific knowledge." 3. As you may well guess before I say it, my position is that there is little possibility of gaining material that could add to scientific knowledge as we now know it. The only type of activity which I can readily perceive as having evidential value would be some maneuver on command by a visible UFO, a specified physical contact, or an actual visitation from an alien being. Although such events have been reported, there is still no method of reproducing this phenomenon at will. The UFOs are everlastingly elusive. 2-3, Ibid. Condon. Edward U. Scientific Studies of Unidentified Flying Objects. New York, Dutton, 1969, p. 1.10. Introduction. This elusive quality is worth noting. From the beginning, UFO sightings and contacts have been highly colored by obscure details and tantalizing mysteries. This shroud of mystery might be very much intended by the UFO nauts, might, in fact, be an integral part of the phenomena. In these messages we find many references to the UFOnauts' motives for their creating this shroud of mystery. Perhaps the non-evidential quality of the telepathy syndrome is one of the keys which will eventually unlock the explanation scheme of a new understanding of science. At any rate, this sort of thinking was what led us on to further data gathering, long after we had become fully aware that there was no hope of securing evidence in the current scientific sense. Reports of telepathic contact with UFOnauts had begun coming in as early as 1952, with George Adamski's claimed contact. In the early 50s, Adamski was joined by a prominent anthropologist, George Hunt Williamson, who also claimed initial contact with UFOnauts using both telepathy and radio telegraphy. George Van Tassel claimed telepathic contact with the UFO occupants at this time, and drew such an interested crowd in response to his published claims that a space convention, which he held at his desert airport, was the subject for an article in a national magazine. Major Wayne R. attended one of these conventions, also reporting UFO contact, including telepathic communications. Major R. has lectured on the UFO phenomenon unceasingly since that time. Daniel Fry claimed that he was taken on board a UFO at White Sands, New Mexico, and many other individuals made similar contact claims. So, when I began to investigate the phenomenon in earnest, two things were abundantly clear: 1, that UFO contact was allegedly possible, and 2, that the scientific establishment in 11, Introduction, General Group these contact reports under the headings of doubtful lunacies, frauds, or material from cultist groups. It was not hard to see why the scientific community would be sorely tempted to classify all UFO contacts in a lump under cultist claims because of the metaphysical or religious orientation of most of the messages which were allegedly received from the extraterrestrial sources. On the surface, such contacts seemed like highly imaginative science fiction stories, or like the creations of fanatic cultist groups seeking frantically for their new messiah. But what the scientific community chose to overlook was the independence of many of the claims from each other claim of contact, and the extreme degree of consistency in the content of the messages. This independence was a fact in my own group. The participants did not know when they started what their goal was or what they should expect to happen to them. The messages which they eventually produced were extremely consistent in content with other alleged UFO messages. In 1963, 1964, and 1965 I made a point of visiting several groups claiming telepathic contact with UFOnauts. I met with groups in Ohio, Florida, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Illinois, and California. Since that time I have not found it helpful further to visit other groups, but I have heard of increasing numbers of functioning groups around the country, in Canada, England and elsewhere in the world. And, in addition to the growing number of voluntary contacts, one can come across many sincerely told stories of involuntary contact, which is sometimes frightening to the unprepared individual. An example of this which has been fairly well documented is Herbert Skirmer's story. Skirmer, a highway patrolman in the Midwest, reported sighting a flying saucer during a routine patrol. The Condon Committee heard of this and put him through age regression hypnosis, a medically approved 12, introduction, therapy for inducing remembrance of traumatic experiences. Under hypnosis, Skirmer recounted contact with the UFOnauts themselves, rather than a simple sighting of a flying saucer. Repeated testing of Skirmer's memory only proved that Skirmer believed very sincerely that his story of contact with extraterrestrials was true. The Condon Committee people could not shake his faith in what he remembered of the UFOnauts. In a book called Gods and Devils from Outer Space, Herb Skirmer's story is told rather fully, and one of the investigating reporters, who seemed well versed in this area, offered a list of general observations regarding the UFO contactees. Among his points was this one concerning the way the contactee allegedly receives his messages from the UFOnauts. While he is being interviewed or questioned, the contactee often seems to be listening to another voice or presence in the room. Often there are pauses in his conversation which last as long as 45 seconds to a minute. After this pause, the answer to a query is given with great lucidity. In interview session wherein the contactee has been hypnotically regressed to the time of contact, he begins his entranced recreation of the experience in normal hypnotic voice trance patterns. When he reaches the time when the message was relayed to him, usually after the mental and physical examination, his voice and manner change, even under hypnotic trance, and he recites, rather than recalls, the dogma which saucer people have relayed to him. For I recognize this description of the contactee's manner when speaking as a messenger for alleged UFOnauts as being similar to the style of speaking used by all the telepathic receivers that I had investigated. 4. Norman, Eric, Gods and Devils from Outer Space. Lancer, NY, 1973. Pages 161-2. 13. Introduction. Another extremely apt description of this telepathic contact is found in John Fuller's book, Interrupted Journey. Included in this volume is a great deal of directly transcribed and quoted material from the file of Betty and Barney Hill. They had gone to a psychiatrist with an anxiety problem. The doctor had performed age regression hypnosis on both of them and uncovered an alleged contact with the space people. This book is an excellent one. Let us look at how Barney Hill describes his contact with the spaceman in this volume. Doctor, did the men speak to you? Barney, only the one I thought was the leader. Doctor, the one you thought was the leader in the spaceship? Barney, yes. Doctor, what kind of language did he use? Barney, he did not speak by word. I was told what to do by his thoughts making my thoughts understand. And I could hear him. And I could not understand in that I could understand him. And I was told that I could not be harmed. Doctor, was this some kind of mental telepathy? Barney, I am not familiar with this term. Doctor, mental telepathy is being able to understand someone else's thoughts or having your thoughts understood by someone else. Barney, I could understand his thoughts. 5. The most important single UFO contactee report I have seen to date is Andrea Buharich's book, Uri, A Journal of the Mystery of Uri Geller, Garden City, Doubleday, 1974. Dr. Buharich, a widely respected researcher into paranormal. 5. Fuller, John, Interrupted Journey, New York, Dial, 1966. Pages 201-2. 14. Introduction. Phenomena such as telepathy, psychic healing and the Kahuna priestly tradition, reports in this volume on the UFO contact story that is most informative and exciting. If you seek out only one book on the physical aspects of contactee phenomena, seek out Urey, by all means. What impressed me in my researching through the data these groups have collected, and through the books published by the more careful of the researchers, was the feeling that I had a puzzle in my hands, and that the pieces were all beginning to fit. I can now say for sure that the puzzle lies outside the boundaries of contemporary orthodox science. Three things have especially impressed me about all this data. One, as I have said, is the extremely high degree of correlation of the material of one group or individual with other groups and sources. Identifications of alleged extraterrestrial sources often match, and the style and content of the messages matches in almost every case. Considerable effort has been put forward in the past 20 years by various organizations in an attempt to ascertain information as to what UFOs are and why they are here. Over 70 books have been published on the subject in the US, and pamphlets and magazine articles have proliferated. The Air Force Project's Grunge and Blue Book were aimed at finding out whether we needed to protect our skies from these UFO invaders. Canada has run two such projects, named Second Story and Magnet. The National Investigations Committee for Aerial Phenomena, with a very large network of volunteer investigators, presented a lengthy report on the subject to Congress in 1964. In 1966, the Condon Committee was formed, backed by a $500,000 government appropriation. Its mission was the investigation of the possible scientific value of UFO-related phenomena. The report of that committee seems to support the actuality of UFOs by its sheer bulk, even though 15, introduction, its conclusion refutes the possibility of advancing science through their study. Another interesting volume, John Fuller's Aliens in Our Skies, contains several eminent scientists' opinions of UFOs, as presented to the House Committee on Science and Aeronautics in 1968. In 1969, the American Association for the Advancement of Science held a two-day debate on UFOs during its annual meeting. The list of published works is too long to annotate. If you wish to delve into the background material on UFOs, please consult the bibliography at the end of this volume for specific references. What many clergy and religious lay people are associating the UFO sightings with is the Day of Judgment, or Armageddon. Many people who believe in UFOs at all believe this interpretation of their meaning. I think the reason is that the truth is somewhere in the area of religion or metaphysics, rather than in science as we know it. Perhaps the concept of Armageddon is far different from the real reason they are here. Still, that concept is at least born of a religious or moral impulse, and I suggest that this religious impulse may be another one of the keys that unlocks the explanation system for a new understanding of science and of the world. It is apparent that as far as the general scientific community is concerned, the idea that UFOnauts could be contacting people on this planet with messages of a religious or metaphysical nature is simply beneath notice. The late Dr. James E. McDonald, of the University of Arizona, included in a list of possible explanations for UFOs the notion that such objects could be spaceships bringing messengers of terrestrial salvation and occult truth, but, he stated, he only listed that hypothesis in order to keep his list scientifically complete. He felt that this hypothesis could not be true. 6. And this attitude of ridicule is standard among most scientists, in spite of 6. Fuller, John, Aliens in Our Skies. New York, Putnam, 1969, p. 91. 16. Introduction, comments from within their own ranks by men who are more open-minded. In 1967, Professor Herman Oberth spoke on the subject of extraterrestrial cultures, and suggested that scientists should tackle problems that may seem fantastic at first. Scholars behave like stuffed geese who refuse to digest anything else. 7. They simply reject new ideas as nonsense. And again, there is the persuasive parable drawn by Dr. McDonald, the same man whom we earlier quoted as finding the messages of the UFOs ridiculous. In fact, the parable becomes just that much more persuasive as we see Dr. McDonald caught in the same trap which he himself describes so well. I quote from Aliens in the Skies. Mr. McDonald is speaking to members of Congress, There is a very real ridicule that has not been contrived by any group. It has just evolved the way the whole problem has unfolded. This is not entirely new in science. It has occurred before. I am sure a number here at the speakers' table are familiar with an interesting chapter in science years ago when meteorites, out of which NASA and many scientists around the world, get a very large amount of useful scientific information, were scorned and scoffed as unreal. It was regarded as nonsense that peasants were telling stories about stones falling out of the sky. The efforts of a few scientists to take a look at the problem and to get some initial data simply were ignored until a very unusual but very real event occurred, in northern France, a meteorite shower. So they sent an eminent academician out to have a look at what these people were talking about, and by golly, the peasants appeared to be right. Everybody in the village, the prefect of police, the local administrators, all the peasants, had seen stones fall out of the seven, Daniken, Eric, chariots of the gods. New York, Putnam, 1967, p. 143.